From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We said to the mayor, we understand the crime problem. We understand because many of our communities have the worst crime problem. But imagine, Mr. Mayor, living in a city where you have to live with the fear of the cops and the robbers. Some in the city worry about the robbers. We have to worry about both.
The Reverend Al Sharpton on the killing of an unarmed African-American man who died in a hail of 50 police bullets. Is this a reprise of the Amadou Diallo killing? We'll speak with Amadou's mother, Kadiatou Diallo. Then a discussion about Israel and Palestine with two leading Palestinian-American voices. Professor Rashid Khalidi will talk about the history of the struggle for Palestinian statehood. Ali Abu Nima has a bold proposal to end the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. One country. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Marine Corps has concluded the U.S. military is no longer able to defeat the insurgency in western Iraq or counter al-Qaeda's rising popularity there. The Washington Post reports the findings appear in a classified intelligence study. The report describes Iraq's Sunni minority as embroiled in a daily fight for survival, fearful of pogroms by the Shia majority, and increasingly dependent on al-Qaeda in Iraq as its only hope against growing Iranian dominance in Baghdad. The memo says that, quote, from the Sunni perspective, their greatest fears have been realized. Iran controls Baghdad and Ambaris have been marginalized. At the United Nations, Secretary General Kofi Annan warned Iraq is almost in a state of civil war.
Well, I think given the developments on the ground, unless something is done drastically and urgently to arrest the deteriorating situation, we could be there. And in fact, we are almost there. Thank you.
NBC News announced on Monday it would begin describing the violence in Iraq as a civil war. NBC became the first TV network to make such a decision, despite objections from the Bush administration. On Monday, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley said, quote, we're clearly in a new phase. The Los Angeles Times reports at least 524 people have died in Iraq since Thursday. In Britain, Defense Secretary Des Brown has announced Britain will begin withdrawing some of its 7,000 troops from Iraq next year.
I can tell you that by the end of next year, I expect numbers of British forces in Iraq to be significantly lower by a matter of thousands. The planning for this has been going on for some months, and I have been pressing our planners to look at all the options to make sure we do not ask a single soldier to remain in Iraq longer than is necessary.
The South Korean government also approved today a plan to remove half of its troops from Iraq. In other Iraq news, a suicide bomber attempted to assassinate the governor of Kirkuk earlier today. The governor survived, but the blast killed one person and wounded 18. On Monday, a U.S. F-15 fighter jet crashed during a bombing mission northwest of Baghdad. The military provided little information on the crash. The Associated Press television network is reporting U.S. soldiers shot and killed 11 civilians and wounded 5 yesterday in a Baghdad suburb. Witnesses told the news agency the U.S. troops showed up and started firing at the homes. The Iraqi government has banned journalists from attending sessions of parliament. A spokesperson for Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki said the decision was designed to make sure people speak with one voice to the media. In other news on the war, Iraqi President Jalal Talabani traveled to Iran Monday and has met with Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Talabani called on Iran to help stem the violence in Iraq and to expand ties between Iran and Iraq. Khamenei told Talabani that U.S. troops must leave Iraq if security is to be restored. In other news from the Middle East, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is heading to the region to hold separate talks with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. The ceasefire in Gaza has entered a third day despite occasional breaches by Palestinian militants. On Monday, Palestinian officials responded to Ehud Olmert's peace offer. This is Nabil Abu Rudaina, spokesperson for the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
Looking forward to seeing this issue resolved immediately, the release of all the prisoners, Palestinians and Israelis. This is a starting point, especially after the truce which was agreed upon yesterday. We have to build on these steps, and we hope that this issue should be solved very soon.
Meanwhile, the Israeli military continues to carry out operations in the West Bank, where Israeli troops seized 13 Palestinians overnight. In other news on Israel, a United Nations agency is accusing Israel of planting landmines in Lebanon during the summer's war. The UN Mine Action Coordination Center made the announcement after a landmine exploded, injuring two European mine disposal experts and a Lebanese medic. A British demining expert was also recently injured in a separate landmine blast. In news from Washington, D.C., the Inspector General of the Justice Department has announced plans to investigate the department's use of information gathered in the government's warrantless surveillance program. The probe, however, will not examine the legality of the controversial National Security Agency program. Here in New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg met with African-American leaders Monday, 2 days after city police officers shot dead an unarmed 23-year-old man hours before his wedding. Bloomberg said it sounds like police used excessive force in the shooting.
I can tell you that it is, to me, unacceptable or inexplicable how you can have 50-odd shots fired. But that's up for the investigation to find out what really happened.
We'll have more on the shooting in a few minutes. Pope Benedict XVI has arrived in Turkey for a 4-day visit that sparked mass protests. This is the Pope's first visit to a Muslim country since his remarks linking Islam and violence. On Saturday, 15,000 people gathered in Ankara to protest his visit. This is Ayasofya, chair of the Alperen Group.
Papa'nın Türkiye'ye, Türk milleti ve İslam
We, the Alperen Group, do not want the Pope, who made insulting statements about the Muslim world, to enter this country and to make it dirty. We will do what we can to avoid this within a democratic framework.
Turkey has said security for the Pope will be even higher than for President Bush's visit 2 years ago. President Bush is heading to the NATO summit in Latvia today. He's expected to join others in urging NATO members to contribute more troops to the war in Afghanistan. This is NATO Secretary General Hapdijoub Scheffer.
We must resource ISAF properly. It is not acceptable that our mission in the South still lacks 20% of its combined joint statement of requirements. I've spoken out repeatedly, and I'll do it here again this morning, about national caveats that take away a commander's flexibility and undermine our operational effectiveness.
In Sri Lanka, the Tamil Tigers have announced they'll resume their struggle to demand the formation of an independent state. The Tamil Tigers leader, Velupillai Prabhakaran, said the 2002 ceasefire has become defunct. A new study in the journal Medicine has concluded AIDS will become one of the top three causes of death worldwide within the next 25 years. AIDS is currently ranked fourth behind heart disease, stroke, and respiratory infections. The report estimates that at least 117 million people will die from AIDS over the next quarter century. Officials in Florida are planning to begin testing touchscreen voting machines in Sarasota County today to determine if the system failed during the recent election. More than 18,000 people in the county went to the polls on Election Day but failed to cast a vote in the highly contested congressional race between Democrat Christine Jennings and Republican Vern Buchanan. The undercount was far higher in Sarasota County than in neighboring areas. According to the Sarasota Herald Tribune, if the missing votes had broken for Jennings by the same percentage as the counted votes in the county, the Democrat would have won the race by about 600 votes instead of losing by 368. Christine Jennings is contesting the election result. This is the former seat of Congressmember, the former Secretary of State of Florida. And in Ecuador, Rafael Correa held a victory rally Monday following his apparent victory in Sunday's presidential election. Correa vowed to oppose a new trade agreement with the United States and not to renew a lease for a U.S. military airbase in Ecuador. He also criticized the U.S.-backed neoliberal economic model.
The model that is being applied not only in Ecuador but throughout Latin America has been disastrous. This neoliberalism has generated unemployment, it has privatized and it has converted into merchandise fundamental human rights like health, education, and social security.
Final election results from Ecuador are still not in, with 74% of the polling stations tallied. As of Monday night, Rafael Correa had 61%. And the Supreme Court in the Democratic Republic of Congo has upheld Joseph Kabila as the winner of the first free elections in 41 years. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg met with black politicians and community leaders at City Hall yesterday, 2 days after the deadly police shooting of an unarmed African-American man in Queens. Early Saturday morning, five officers fired 50 shots at a car carrying 23-year-old Sean Bell, who had just left his bachelor's party on the eve of his wedding. He was with two friends. None of them were armed. Bell died before reaching the hospital. His friend Joseph Guzman remains in critical condition after being hit by 11 bullets, and Trent Benefield is in stable condition with wounds to his leg. Following the talks, Mayor Bloomberg held a news conference with Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly and city leaders. Bloomberg expressed confidence in Kelly, but said police officers may have used excessive force.
Nobody takes this more seriously than Commissioner Kelly and I do. We are both very proud of our police department and the officers that work there. But I can't tell you that every time everyone does the right thing. And whether they did the right thing or not this time, it sounds to me like excessive force was used, but that's up to the district attorney to find out. And I do not want to prejudice their investigation.
Queens District Attorney Richard Brown said Monday his office is investigating the shootings and the results will be presented to a grand jury. The five officers have meanwhile been placed on administrative duties. They've yet to be interviewed by police officials. According to Commissioner Kelly, the officers were there staking out the club for prostitution and drug activity. Police sent two undercover cops inside where they apparently spent the next few hours nursing drinks and mingling with the crowd. Neither officer was given a breathalyzer test afterwards. The situation began to unravel when one of the undercover cops alerted the backup team outside that a man inside was possibly armed. The police claim the shooting occurred after Bell's car hit one of the undercover officers and an unmarked police minivan. Friends and family of Bell say they may have mistaken the plainclothes officers for robbers and tried to get away. The undercover officer fired first, squeezing off 11 rounds. Another officer, a 12-year veteran, fired 31 times, meaning he paused to reload. The shootings provoked outrage and raised new questions about racial profiling in the NYPD. The Reverend Al Sharpton, who attended Monday's talk, spoke to reporters outside City Hall afterwards.
To my left is Bishop Lester Williams, who is a pastor for the Bell family. We have Bishop Williams, who is with the Guzman family, of course, Reverend Herbert Daughtry, and our fighting councilman, Charles Barron. We were part of about two-hour meeting with the mayor and police commissioner. It was a very candid, very blunt meeting. We said what we felt. He responded. I think that the main thing we have said is that this city must show moral outrage, that 50 shots were fired on three unarmed men. There must also be a review of policy that allows drinking while vice squad people are working, and there is no real testing. There is no test, the sobriety test given at the scene. We also expressed that there has been a pattern of disrespect, disregard, and absolute unfairness in our community, a pattern that must stop, and that there must be a dramatic change in how this administration from the top deals with it. Councilman Barron has been very public about his call on the police commissioner stepping down. 100 blacks in law enforcement found him to have a no vote of confidence. But we said to the mayor, we are meeting this afternoon with the DA. We do not in any way, shape, or form see how these police could have operated in any way that one could find was not beyond the law. At what point do you continue to fire, even reload, and not realize that no one is shooting at you? And to say that one gun causes an atmosphere where you keep shooting is to tell me and everyone that was sitting in that room that if one policeman makes a mistake, you could be subjected innocently to what could amount to a firing squad. That is no way to run a city. And that is no way to give comfort. We said to the mayor, we understand the crime problem. We understand because many of our communities have the worst crime problems. But imagine, Mr. Mayor, living in a city where you have to live with the fear of the cops and the robbers. Some in the city worry about the robbers. We have to worry about both. And that was the appeal that we made. This mayor has better manners than his predecessor. Let's see if we have better policy. We prefer talking than not talking. But the object is not a conversation. The object is fairness and justice. So is it better that he met than Giuliani didn't? Let's see what the results are. Because we're not just interested in being treated politely. We're interested in being treated fairly and rightly. And that will happen when police are held as accountable as anyone else. Lastly, there are those that are calling for peace and calm. The presence of peace is justice. Many are not calling for peace. They're calling for quiet. They want us to shut up and suffer in silence. If you want peace, you give justice. You don't tell people to shut up when they're hurting. You find out their pain, and you resolve the pain. And people wouldn't be hollering if they weren't in pain. Thank you very much. We're going to help the family with the funeral arrangement.
The Reverend Al Sharpton speaking outside City Hall on Monday. Many people compared the shooting of Sean Bell to the death of Amadou Diallo. He was killed on February 4, 1999, when police fired 41 shots at him as he was entering his apartment. An Albany, New York jury acquitted the officers of all the criminal charges, but eventually his family was awarded $3 million. Amadou's mother, Kadiatou Diallo, joins us now from Washington, D.C. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Kadiatou Diallo.
Thank you, Emmy.
It's good to have you with us. You just happened to be in New York City this weekend for the premiere of a movie about Amadou called The Death of Two Sons when this took place in Jamaica, Queens. Is that right?
It took place on East Village at 2nd and 2nd Avenue in New York City at the African Diaspora Film Festival. We were screening the film there, and the audience, after the film was finished, we opened for question and answers. There was a gentleman who came right from the rally of Reverend Al Sharpton, and he informed me that this incident has took place in Queens.
And your response?
I was shocked. I could not believe it, having to live the tragedy and trauma of losing my son in police bullet, 41 bullets, February 4, 1999. We were sure that it's going to be tough, but I dedicated my life to join the community and ask for positive changes. Ever since then, I have, through the Amadou Diallo Foundation, Inc., traveled across the country to speak about sensitivity and speak about police brutality. I have contributed so much with other mothers whose children has been also victimized by the police. To name a few, Mrs. Baez, whose son, Anthony Baez, was also killed in the Bronx. And Mrs. Bush, the mother of Gideon Bush, whose son was also killed. And we wanted to talk to, in a different way, tell the story so that we can bring the community at large with all ethnicity to face this crisis and speak on common cause to help us ease the problem. It's not the case, apparently, because look at what happened now.
Kadiatou Diallo, if you could remind our audience what happened and the similarities. I mean, of course, there are many differences. Your son, 22 years old, in New York City, died in a hail of 41 police bullets. In this case, and that was four police officers. This is five.
Yes.
Sean Bell died in a hail of 50 bullets.
Yes. Amadou Diallo was working that day. He came little before midnight in the Bronx at 1157 Wheeler Avenue. And he got in the apartment and spoke with his roommate. And he said he was tired, but he wanted to go out to find something to eat. Then he got out. Four police officers belonging to the street crime unit were driving on marked car, and all were in civilian clothes, armed with 9mm weapons and loaded with 16 bullets each. They saw my son in the vestibule, at the entrance of the vestibule where he lived, and they came right at him and with their guns drawn and started shooting at him. That's what happened, and which led to the death of my son, an innocent young man who have a future, was working hard as a vendor in Manhattan to save money to pay his way to college. I heard that Bell also was out that night and celebrating a wonderful, wonderful time with his friends, which was a bachelor party because he was going to get married, according to the report what I read. The similarity of the case, I think to me, is that one thing is for and foremost is that Bell was a young man, black man, in the night, middle of the night. The officers were in civil, their undercover officers, and driving unmarked car too. So I don't know about the other details of the shooting, but I do know the fact that Bell was a young black man, 23 years old. The stereotyping exists. What I'm speaking about throughout the country is that young black male has been profiled before my son was killed and after. It's still happening. We have to call for change.
Mrs. Diallo, last night on a lot of the news programs, the police were represented in force. And one of the theories that was put forward that I heard repeated over and over again on the networks is this theory of contagious shooting, that it's something that's uncontrollable, that when one officer fires, it's something that just becomes automatic, and other officers fire. And it's a phenomenon, police officers were saying, and the commissioner, that they are looking at now, called contagious shooting. Your response?
It's interesting. I don't think if this incident was in Manhattan, I truly believe that if this incident happened in Manhattan with a white male driving at night, like Sean was driving with his friend, I don't think they would have contagious actions. Coming back to the fact that Amy, they portray the black male as dangerous and wild. Each time the encounter happened, that is the case. We have to face the fact that young black male are stereotyped as violent criminal in most cases, whenever shooting cases happen between black male and police officers. If in their mentality they are facing the threat, what they call threat is the black male that they are apprehending. This led to the tragedy that is happening all the time. So I really salute the mayor for the response that he did, which was different than the former administration when my son was killed. He's talking with the community leaders. And the police commissioner, Raymond Kelly, I remember, is in record. When he took office, he said, this time, cases like Amadou Diallo will never happen under my watch. So why this happen again? This is my question.
There were five police officers in this case, apparently two African-American, two Latino, one white officer. The white officer was the one who fired 31 times, a many-year veteran of the police force. We don't know a lot about them or what they're saying, and it goes back to something you also dealt with, and I was wondering if you would explain this. Something in New York that's known as the 48-hour rule.
Mm-hmm.
What is that?
The 48-hour rule I learned after talking with many elected officials was a time given to officers whenever they are involved in shooting case that they cannot talk, they would not be interviewed, they would not be tested for drug or alcohol. We proposed a package under the leadership with Rubén Díaz, from the representative of the Bronx. A package bill was called the Diallo and Baez bill. We went to Albany to lobby for the bill to be passed so that any time a police officer used their gun to innocent person, they would be subject to right away being tested for drug and alcohol. The bill died in the House.
We also know, according to Police Commissioner Raymond Kelly, that two of the officers were inside the club and were drinking. I think they said had two drinks.
Yes. I mean, if they—you remember the Doris Monk case. As soon as he was killed, his record was opened up, even the sealed record. They opened it up and talk about his past. If the officers who are responsible for the crime does not be subject, put them into the same level, like which means they have to answer questions and be submitted to testing, is unfair, is unbalanced, I think, in my view.
Apparently, they say they just have to be approved by, they don't have to be tested, but just have to be approved by a supervising officer.
That's interesting.
Well, this case is going to go to a grand jury, according to the Queens District Attorney. What do you see unfolding? We have seen over the last few days major protests taking place. In the case of your son, you had Congressman Charles Rangel arrested. You had the former mayor David Dinkins arrested at Police Plaza, demanding that there be justice. What do you see happening here, and do you have any words of advice?
First and foremost, my heart goes out to the Bell family, and I pray for the two young men who are in the hospital to be recovered their health and be able to testify as to what happened. I have seen Reverend Sharpton standing up like the way he stood up for us when my son was killed, and other elected officials went with him to meet with the mayor. I expect for them to continue to put pressure so that the community will receive justice. To the family, I hope that they can have proper representation, because it's a long road, it's a difficult one. You remember when the indictment was given to the four officers who were responsible for killing my son. After the indictment, we were hoping that the trial will happen in the Bronx, where the crime happened. And the judge, one judge, gave the officers, granted them a change of venue. I hope that this will not happen this time, because had the trial happened in the Bronx, I think the outcome of the criminal case when the officers who killed my son were tried, would be different, because they were acquitted of all charges. Because you remember, Amy, the trial was moved to Albany, where I was told, there was no conviction against police officers in Albany.
We're Katiadu Diallo, we have to wrap it there, and I want to thank you very much for being with us. I'm sure we will come back to you over the case that is happening today, and
thank
we will
you.
Continue to
thank
cover
Thank you,
it.
Amy. I want
Thank you very much. Katiadu Diallo, mother of Amadou Diallo, shot 41 times by New York police on February 4th, 1999. Back in a minute.
Shots, and we'll take that ride across this bloody river to the other side. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Well, is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret.
Springsteen singing 41 Shots. When he first came out with the song in 2000, the police union called on police officers to boycott his performances and not to work overtime in security at his events. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM college and community radio stations, on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We're also broadcasting on public access TV stations and PBS stations, and we are video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the latest from Israel and the Palestinian territories, but first, an unusual moment last night on American television. Appearing on CNN's Larry King Live, a former U.S. president and leading Middle East peacemaker, fiercely critical of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza.
And the oppression of the Palestinians by Israeli forces in the occupied territories is horrendous. And it's not something that has been acknowledged or even discussed in this country. The basic purpose...
Why not?
I don't know why not. You never hear anything about what is happening to the Palestinians by the Israelis. As a matter of fact, it's one of the worst cases of oppression that I know of now in the world. The Palestinians' land has been taken away from them. They now have an encapsulating or an imprisonment wall being built around what's left of the little tiny part of the Holy Land that is in the West Bank, in the Gaza, from which Israel is now withdrawing. Gaza is surrounded by a high wall. There's only two openings in it, one into Israel, which is mostly closed, the other one into Egypt. The people there are encapsulated. And the deprivation of basic human rights among the Palestinians is really horrendous. And this is a fact that's known throughout the world. is debated heavily and constantly in Israel. Yes. Every time I'm there, the debate's going on. It is not debated at all in this country. And
that was, of course, former President Jimmy Carter speaking on CNN's Larry King Live. And he was talking about his new book. It's called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. And it's generating heavy controversy here in the United States. Carter's comments come as Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert gave a major address Monday in which he said he was prepared to offer Palestinians concessions to make peace. Olmert said Israel would return parts of the West Bank towards the creation of a Palestinian state. He called on Palestinians to renounce violence, give up the right of return, and accept a prisoner exchange for the captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit. Olmert's comments mark the first time he's endorsed the idea of a prisoner exchange since Israel launched its attack on Gaza in June. Olmert did not give new ideas on some of the most contentious issues, including Israeli settlements and the status of Jerusalem. But he said peace would be based on the Bush administration's position that any new agreement would reflect the reality of Israel's annexation of large parts of the West Bank for its settlements. Olmert's speech comes one day after Israel pulled out of the Gaza Strip as part of a new ceasefire. Israel's five-month offensive in Gaza has killed more than 400 Palestinians, including at least 74 under the age of 18. Fighting continues in the West Bank, where Israeli forces arrested 13 Palestinians overnight. Well, today we'll spend the rest of the program with two leading Palestinian-American voices. Both have new books on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Joining me here in our Firehouse studio is Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies and the Director of the Middle East Institute at Columbia University. His new book is called The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. First, your response to this former U.S. President Jimmy Carter and his book.
Well, I certainly couldn't agree more with what he said on CNN last night. There's no question but that there's been a blanket of silence for 39 and a half years and running in most of the mainstream media about what is happening daily in the occupied territories. The very fact that they are occupied territories and that it's been 39 and a half years is never, never mentioned in most news reports.
The fact that he's an American president talking about this, well, is this unusual?
That's why he got on Larry King. It's very, very hard to get those kinds of words across something like CNN. It is important. I mean, this is a man who's gone around the world and I think very ably represented this country in terms of standing at elections, watching them, supervising them, and I think he's a man who has enormous credibility, though it's amazing how the Democratic Party is twisting and turning on the issue of his book.
Why do you think that is, the Democratic Party?
Well, the politicians who have disassociated themselves from President Carter are all Democrats, interestingly enough.
Who?
I can't remember each specific senator or congressman, but there was a lemming-like rush away from the president on the part of a number of them. I think because anything that's said against Israel arouses an enormous, ferocious emotional response among some people, and politicians are afraid of that. The media are afraid of that. And so I don't think that we get anything like a balanced discussion of the issues. In fact, a discussion of the issues is what many people would like to avoid. And I think that that's what the president himself said. We don't have these things discussed in this country. They certainly are in Israel, as he said. They're discussed everywhere else. They're just not discussed here.
Why did you call your book The Iron Cage?
I called it The Iron Cage because that was the metaphor that occurred to me in trying to explain the kind of constraints that the Palestinians operated under during the mandate period. And then I realized that's still true today, in a sense. They are within, bounded within, both physical and constitutional and legal constraints that make it very, very hard for them to operate. The focus of the book is not on that, however. It's on what they have done or not done within those constraints.
Talk about Ehud Olmert's speech and what he is offering in the context of, and I think, as you say, without this discussion, people don't even understand the history.
Right.
In the context of the history, as you talk about the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood.
Well, there's deep history and there's current history. The current history is 39 and a half years of occupation. The deeper history, which I try and go into in this book, has to do with what happened before 1948, in 1948, and since. The problem doesn't just go back to 1967. So what Olmert is talking about is a rearrangement of the current status of the occupied territories, with Israel, as you said, keeping much of what it occupied in 1967, what President Bush in April 2004 basically granted Israel, the so-called settlement blocks, which are undefined areas which cut the West Bank into at least three pieces, but which could expand, continue to expand as they have been over many, many years. So there's nothing new in the proposal as far as I can tell, and it essentially involves a rearrangement of the status quo before 2000.
We'll go back in time. We have time for this. Talk about the deep history.
Well, the deep history has to do with a country that had a majority that was Arab, in which the British helped the Zionist movement to establish what was called in the Balfour Declaration a national home for the Jewish people. That was understood by the British and by the Zionists to mean a Jewish state in all of Palestine. And that was the objective, I think, from the beginning. What nobody really took very seriously into account was that Arab majority, the fact that it had a national consciousness, that it saw itself as having rights, and that even by the documents that the British themselves had helped produce, the Covenant of the League of Nations, that population did have rights, a right of national self-determination. What I talk about in the book is how that right was never granted, how the Palestinians were never able to achieve it, how obstacles were thrown in their path. And then 1948 involves the expulsion of a majority of the Palestinians from their homes. It involves the establishment, obviously, of Israel, but the non-establishment of the Arab state, which the United Nations had called for. And I go into why that happened as well.
The difference between the British rule and the Israeli rule?
Well, there are some similarities. The emergency regulations that the British passed in 1945 are still applied for things like administrative detention, an innovation which our law now includes in the form of the Military Commissions Act, where you can just be put in jail on the say-so of some government official. So there are obviously other differences. The British pretended that they were trying to fairly judge between the two sides. In fact, they had a very deep commitment to Zionism that was only tempered in 1939 when they came to realize how impossible it was to ram the Zionist project down the throats of the Palestinians and the rest of the Arab world.
How did the Israelis expel the Palestinians?
By force, by fear. In many cases, people fled without actually having been attacked, out of terror after hearing of massacres or reports of massacres elsewhere. It was absolutely necessary. The 55% of a country that had a 65% Arab majority, which was to have become a Jewish state under the partition plan of 1947, that 55% had almost parity between Arabs and Jews. You wouldn't have had a Jewish state in that 55% unless that population, or a large part of it, had been expelled. So, moreover, most of the property in that 55% was Arab-owned. So it was almost a necessary and inevitable prerequisite for the establishment of a Jewish state in a country that had 65% Arab majority.
What about your family's own story?
Well, I mean, my family comes from Jerusalem, my father's family. Some members of my family were deeply involved in politics. One of them was, I mention him and others in various of my writings. Played a pretty important role in the 30s and 40s. I'm critical of that whole generation of leadership in the book because I think they really failed to meet the challenge that they faced. But
What do you think they should have done?
Well, there are many things that they should have done. One thing that they should not have done is to react the way they did to the British. The British came there and put into place a series of constraints that they should not, under any circumstances, have accepted. Many of them, not just the Mufti, not just my uncle, not just a number of other people, accepted positions in a British mandatory administration which was predicated on the denial of their national existence. That was a mistake, obviously. They made many other mistakes. I mean, there was only a moment in which a compromise might have been possible with the Zionist movement when it was weak, late 20s, early 30s. They didn't take that chance. There was only a moment when real resistance to the British might have changed things, as it did in Iraq and Egypt, in Syria in the 20s. The Palestinians didn't revolt till the end of the 30s, and
Why?
It was a popular revolt. That's a hard question to answer. I mean, I actually don't answer it in the book because I'm not sure why. Everywhere else you had major armed national revolts against colonial imperial rule, not in Palestine until the very end of the 30s.
We're talking to Professor Rashid Khalidi. He's the Edward Said Professor of Arab Studies at Columbia University, author of a number of books. His latest is called The Iron Cage, the story of the Palestinian struggle for statehood. We come back, we'll also be joined by Ali Abu Nima. He has also written a book, a controversial, bold proposal, and that is One Country. Stay with us.
disguise as an Orthodox Jew on a crowded bus in Jerusalem. Some had survived.
Tom Waits, Road to Peace, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Our guest in studio here in New York is Professor Rashid Khalidi. His latest book is called The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. Joining us in studio in Chicago is Ali Abu Nima. He is the creator and editor of the Electronic Intifada and more recently of Electronic Iraq. His new book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israeli-Palestinian Impasse. Ali Abu Nima, thank you for joining us. Lay out that proposal, please.
Thank you, Amy. What I lay out in the book is really an old idea, which I think needs to be revived and discussed most vigorously. And really, it's the proposition in the title, One Country, recognition that what we have in Palestine, Israel, is one country. It is an Israeli-ruled country in which half the population, 5 million Israeli Jews, has a monopoly on political, economic, and military power. And the other half, Palestinians, are disenfranchised either partially or totally. And what I'm arguing is that really the conventional wisdom that partition is the solution is completely wrong. And in fact, partition is the problem. I think Rashid's book, which is really an important and major new light on some of this history, helps illuminate that partition has always been associated with ethnic cleansing, with the dispossession of the Palestinians, really from when it was first suggested in 1937, when the British suggested partitioning Palestine. They said that you would have to forcibly transfer hundreds of thousands, at that time nearly the majority of the Palestinian population, in order to create a Jewish state. And as Rashid said, Israel could only come out through the continued dispossession of Palestinians. So what I'm saying is we need to do the work of imagining a different kind of future, one in which Israelis and Palestinians can start to see themselves together. That's very, very hard work in the current context, but I think looking at other examples around the world, like South Africa, like Northern Ireland, even like Canada, where they're still struggling with these issues as we see today, there is a different path that we have to seize other than the apartheid reality Israel is creating with the world's complicity.
Ali Abu Nima, on the issue of a one-state solution, I wanted to go back for a moment to former President Jimmy Carter. During his appearance on CNN last night, he was asked about this one-state idea.
To incorporate the occupied territories into Israel and have just one state, I don't think that would work, and I tell you why. First of all, the Palestinians, if they were given the right to vote on an equal basis with all the Israelis, they would play a major role in making decisions about the whole country. And with the rapid population growth of the Palestinians, which in Gaza is 4.7% a year, one of the highest in the world, in the foreseeable future, the Palestinians would actually have a majority in that nation. So I think the only real practical solution is to have two states side by side in their own territories living in harmony and peace. That's, I think, the best and most likely approach.
So that was former President Jimmy Carter on CNN Larry King Live. But I also wanted to ask you about the charge that advocating a one-state solution, in fact, helps the strongest opponents of Palestinian rights. The argument has been made by people like, well, MIT professor Noam Chomsky, who says he favors the two-state solution not because it's the most just, but because it's the most realistic. He writes, quote, "In my opinion, it's improper to dangle hopes that will not be realized before the eyes of people suffering in misery and oppression. Rather, constructive efforts should be pursued to mitigate their suffering and deal with their problems in the real world." Your response?
Well, I think those views are both reflections of a very flawed conventional wisdom, and I take that on directly in the book. Consider this reality, Amy. There is a multi-billion dollar peace process industry that has been out there for decades saying the only solution is the two-state solution. And as we see, there is no Palestinian state. It was promised, President Bush promised a Palestinian state in 2005. We're close to 2007. It is the hope of a Palestinian state that has been dangled cynically in front of the Palestinians for decades. And what President Carter is saying, and I applaud, I'm thrilled by his interventions, by his book, and by his interview on Larry King Live. But I think on this particular issue, he's reflecting a flawed conventional wisdom, because what's he saying? He's saying that the reason to oppose a one-state solution is because it would be democracy, that Palestinians would have equal rights, one person, one vote, and an equal share in deciding the future of the country. What I argue in the book, of course, this isn't about destroying Israel. It isn't about turning things over from one day to the next. Palestine, Israel is not the only country that faces this sort of power struggle along ethnic, religious, and other lines. We have to look for structures, and I talk about this in some detail in the book, how they did it in South Africa, where, by the way, the same sorts of arguments were made against ending apartheid and against one person, one vote. We have to look at countries like Belgium. We have to look at Northern Ireland. There are many models out there for dealing with those sort of things so that you have one person, one vote, full democracy, full equality, while at the same time ethnic communities, the Israeli Jewish community, the Palestinian community, will have mechanisms for expressing their national identity, for decision-making over issues that concern them. We have to stop thinking in this very simplistic binary way. And this is where I'm trying to take the discussion with this book.
Let me ask Professor Rashid Khalidi your response. Which do you feel is the most viable solution today?
Well, I would say two things. The first is that anybody who wants to talk about a two-state solution has to talk about how you would reverse the trends that have been ongoing for at least four decades. The annexation of Palestinian land, the usurpation of Palestinian property in order to create the settlements, that the chopping up of the West Bank into cantons, the erection of a matrix of control whereby every important decision the Palestinians take is ultimately passed through an Israeli screen and there are Israeli arbiters, Ministry of Interior, security services, military, control everything. I'm talking about birth, death, entry, exit, export, import, everything of importance. You would have to reverse that whole process before you could even talk about the 23% of Palestine, which is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, becoming a Palestinian state. And I see those processes as having been given enormous additional impetus by President Bush's saying that the settlement blocks are realities that have to be taken into account in any settlement. So reverse U.S. policy first, reverse everything that Israel has done for almost 40 years in the occupied territories, and then come and talk about a Palestinian state. The second thing that has to be taken into consideration, in my view, is that both Palestinians and Israelis are very attached to the idea of having their own state. Now, these are not just ethnic communities. These are peoples that have developed powerful senses of national identity, in part in conflict with one another. And to talk about how you move them towards a future of peace in which you have one state and they're operating within a single political system involves not just a whole process of education and structures, which Ali does talk about in his book, but overcoming what seems to be very strong majority views in both peoples about how they want to organize their national life. There are people in Israel and more in Palestine, but minorities in both cases who want some kind of one-state solution. They don't all want the same one, by the way. But they are distinct minorities. So I think you have to address both of those things, irrespective of which solution you want.
Ali Abunima.
Well, I think Rashid is pointing out the key obstacles. People who say that a two-state solution is realistic are ignoring the reality on the ground, that there is one state. Already, it is basically a greater Israel in which Palestinians are disenfranchised. These people are inseparable. And I think that for many people, the idea of two states acts as a sort of a placebo. It gets us off the hook from looking at the reality that these people are deeply intertwined. They are as inseparable as blacks and whites in South Africa, and as inseparable as nationalists and unionists, Catholics, Protestants in Northern Ireland. And like South Africans and like people in Ireland, they have to start dealing with that reality. On the issue of what people on both sides think, it's clear that the majority of Israelis are deeply attached to their own state, a state in which they are dominant, the dominant class, as whites were in South Africa. I think with Palestinians it's much more mixed. When you look at the opinion polls within the West Bank and Gaza, it's remarkable how high support is for a single democratic, multi-ethnic state, not an Islamic state in which there are no Jews, but a multi-ethnic democratic state, is remarkably high given that there are no Palestinian leaders out there openly advocating this. And support for a two-state solution is remarkably tepid given the fact that there is this multi-billion dollar industry promoting it, and all the parties say that they're for it. When you look at Palestinians, the rest of the Palestinian community, the more than a million Palestinians living as Israeli citizens, second-class citizens, have been struggling for decades for a state of all its citizens. So I would see them as supporting the goal of a state of equal rights. And for Palestinians in the diaspora, the issue of a two-state solution has always remained contentious because the way Israel conceives it, as Ehud Olmert put it just yesterday, means that the vast majority of Palestinians would have to give up their rights. So in the book, and I talk about these new discussions, both among Palestinians and Israelis, moving towards this new sort of
vision. We just have about a minute and a half to go, and I want to tie this into what's happening today in Iraq, how you see it related. Do you see solution to the Palestinian-Israel conflict essential to peace in Iraq as well?
I think what's essential is that the mindset that has dominated American policymaking has to change fundamentally, whether in Iraq, in Palestine, in Lebanon, or elsewhere. The "we won't talk to you unless you do what we want" syndrome that this administration has perfected is bankrupt and has led us into the abyss. Much of what we think, the conventional wisdom about places like Palestine, will have to be discarded. I'd love to say that I see a new horizon in Iraq or in Palestine because of what Olmert has done or because the Democrats have won the elections. Unfortunately, I don't. There's a huge body of conventional wisdom which is entirely wrong and which has led us where we are. And more of it than we realize is bipartisan on the Middle East. All of that has to change, unfortunately.
And Ali Abu Nima, solution right now in Iraq.
Well, I agree absolutely with what Rashid has said. I think the most important thing we can do is what Jimmy Carter said on Larry King, is we have to start talking about this, shattering the conventional wisdom, shattering the silence that has made free discussion of Palestine-Israel such a taboo in this country for so long.
Ali Abu Nima and Professor Rashid Khalidi, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Ali Abu Nima's book is called One Country, A Bold Proposal to End the Israel-Palestinian Impasse, and Professor Khalidi's book, The Iron Cage, The Story of the Palestinian Struggle for Statehood. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy of the show, you can go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Mate, Lee Burek, and Jen Utes. Mike DeFilippo and Nick Marsilio are our engineers. Special thanks to Megan Whitney, Angela Alston, Hugh Grand, Kieran Craig-Meadows, John Randolph, Danielle Strandberg-Peshkin, Samantha Chambly. Again, our website where you get our headlines and summaries of our broadcast at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.